Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Listen to KMOX anytime, anywhere. Download the Radio.com app today.
Would you walk us through a typical day?
Burger King, Wendy's, and McDonald's.
Stop spending!
I'm president, and you're not.
This is the greatest country in the world. But we do have some really stupid people representing it from time to time.
I am proud to shut down the government. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it.
Now, Mark Reardon.
I don't think he's a smart person, but he's got a loud voice.
On St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Well, once again, we open up the show with lots of moving pieces here this afternoon. There's a story that Carol had here just a short time ago. We got a news release, and the news release is a little different than what the go figure, what the Post-Dispatch is reporting. And this is about our former governor, Eric Greitens, who, and here's Jack Sunstrip's story in the, well, I guess this is J.B. Forbes. That's the photograph. Yeah, Jack Sunstrip and Kurt Erickson, Post-Dispatch. Ethics Commission fines Eric Greitens $178,000 for campaign finance violations. Here's what their story says. I'm just going to tell you what their story says here. State ethics regulators have fined the campaign of former Governor Eric Greitens $178,000 over campaign finance violations dating to Greitens' upstart outsider bid to become Missouri's chief executive. The Ethics Commission released its long-awaited assessment of Greitens' campaign apparatus on Thursday. The commission found reasonable grounds to believe the Greitens campaign committed some violations of Missouri law, but not others alleged in the complaint. A consent order says Greitens can pay $38,000 of the fine and be done with the case so long as no more violations occur. Now, the news release that went out from Catherine Hanaway and the law firm representing Eric Greitens said he's completely exonerated, did nothing wrong. And I, you know, I'll be honest with you, this caught me off guard, and I've not spoken with Eric in probably 8 months. He called me. I told this story. He called me last summer. We had a brief conversation. I anticipated that there would be a follow-up because it was indicated to me that there was something that was basically going to come down relatively quickly. That did not happen until last month. So I'd love to have him on to ask some questions about this, but this one even caught me a little bit off guard. And we'll just leave it at that for now. And there's some things developing. Maybe we'll get lucky here and get him on the air this afternoon. We have a roundtable tomorrow that will certainly be up for discussion. Jane Duker, Gene Effins, Jeff Smith, all on the panel. You can always follow on Twitter at Mark Reardon, KMOX. If you miss any part of the show, you can download the podcast at KMOX.com/Reardon. And, of course, you can listen live by downloading the Radio.com app. We have another story that we've been focusing here on KMOX. In fact, the news department here is going to turn this into a bit of a special tomorrow because last Friday, Carol Daniel and our news director, Beth, went to see Kim Gardner and sat down and had a three-hour interview. It was supposed to be just an hour. It turned into a three-hour sit-down interview with the circuit attorney, the controversial circuit attorney, who has only made herself available seemingly in the more recent times to national, you know, people. Jeff Begays at CBS, who swooped in here and did that nonsense story a couple of weeks ago. Now, I heard one of these stories. Carol's going to come in here in just a few minutes and talk about this to a certain extent. What we found out, I haven't heard the entire interview because we're sort of releasing it in bits and pieces. This is what I heard on the news this morning, and I was a little confused by this. So we'll ask Carol and we'll see if we can get to the bottom of this here in a few minutes.
How would you characterize your relationship with the police department as a not you personally, but as an agency, as a part of the ecosystem?
It's always going to be an adversary relationship. I mean, we're going to always ask them to go back to complete their investigation, do more things. That is our job. We're a check and balance.
Okay. We're a check and balance. I thought that the prosecutor, this is where I'm confused. I thought the prosecutor, the circuit attorney in any given situation was supposed to put the people that the police were arresting behind bars. So why is there an adversarial relationship? Now, I called Jack Coder, Alderman Jack Coder used to be a prosecutor, and I asked him, I said, is there an adversarial relationship? He goes, no, it's actually exactly the opposite. Now, that's not to say that the prosecutor doesn't have a role, and here's what Jack said. He said, look, a lot of times you have to be pretty pretty bold with the cops to say, we want to make sure that this is buttoned up, or, you know, you're doing this wrong. So there is a, I think, a relationship that should exist, and a healthy one, between the circuit attorney's office and the police department. So that one really caught me off guard. All right, some of the other things that are making news this this afternoon. Let me just touch on this one because people are going crazy about it on Twitter. There's two things that people are going crazy about today on Twitter. We're going to actually get into both of them. One, have you seen the video of the guy that's sitting in the back of an airplane and there's a woman in front of him and she's reclining her seat and the guy does not like it, so he starts pounding on the back of the seat. It's gone viral and people are taking their positions. They are taking sides. Clay Travis had a poll this morning. When I took the poll question was this. For the record, he said, I'm 100% opposed to seats reclining on airplane flights. Should airplane flights seats be designed to recline? So there was a poll question. I voted in that poll. I said, yes, absolutely. Dave, what would you say? Come on. You say no. Why? Well, you're in the majority. When I took the poll, 69% of people said no. 31% said yes. Of course they should recline. It's about comfort. I'm paying $300, $400, $500, $600 to fly in the air. I want comfort, right? So we're getting into that. The other thing is about Jim Carrey. Klein, you said you didn't even hear about this one yet. This is interesting. Talk about the cancel culture. We'll see if it applies to Jim Carrey. I'm going to review the movie Sonic the Hedgehog tomorrow. Believe it or not, it's a pretty good movie. I'm shocked by it. Well, Jim Carrey's in the movie. So, and I do these things a lot with the Hollywood types. I used to do them a lot more. You sit down, you do interviews. They're called junkets. So there was a young lady named Charlotte Long of Heat Magazine sitting down in a junket interview with Jim Carrey. And Sonic the Hedgehog, which apparently is a video game. I had no idea. Okay, don't laugh at me. I'm not a video guy. Too many things to do. I'm not good at them. That's part of the problem. Sonic the Hedgehog in the movie, voiced by Ben Schwartz, who does a great job, has a bucket list, and he's trying to cross things off his bucket list. So this reporter is sitting down with Jim Carrey, Charlotte Long, and says, what is on your bucket list? Now, I'm going to tell you right now that the audio is a bit protected. I tried to get this from her Twitter site because she posted it on there, and she has to allow me to follow her, so we're going to wait and see if that happens. And there have been some other outlets that have used the audio, but they have music behind them. But here's what he said. Again, the question from Charlotte is, what's on your bucket list?
All you've done in your career and in your life, is there anything still left on your bucket list?
Just you.
Wow.
So he says, listen to that again, he says, just you. Just, oh, more than a little creepy, right?
Just you.
Wow.
That's it. It's all done now.
I don't know what to say to that.
Just own it.
You know, there is a little light flirting going on there. She seemed to be a little embarrassed. Well, people are teeing off on Jim Carrey today on that, you know, being in somewhat of a predatory light. I will say this. Look, Jim Carrey is Jim Carrey. He's weird. There's a lot of things that he's done in the past few years that I think are a little bit more crazy and offensive than that. I'll be very curious to see how he's treated in the aftermath of this, especially given the Me Too movement. But Jim Carrey seems like one of those guys, he doesn't really care, right? Doesn't really care what happens. All right, let's see. Something else I wanted to touch on this afternoon. I got to be careful because there's so much going on here, and Carol's coming in just a couple of minutes. I may save some of this because I don't want to run out of time. One of the things that is being discussed, I'll just give you a little flavor of this, and we'll talk about it later in the show, later in the hour. I'll commit to that. Rush was off again today, but, and I did not hear this yesterday. He either said it yesterday or the day before about Mayor Pete, and it became somewhat controversial. And Brianna Keeler from CNN introed the segment with SE Cup a few hours ago this way.
Just a week after receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom, right-wing radio personality Rush Limbaugh is making offensive and what you could easily call homophobic remarks. They are homophobic about Pete Buttigieg, the first openly gay presidential candidate. This is what Limbaugh said.
All right, now I'll play just a little bit of what Rush said here.
They're sitting there and they're looking at Mayor Pete. 37-year-old gay guy, Mayor South Bend, loves to kiss his husband on the debate stage. And they're saying, okay, how's this going to look? 37-year-old gay guy kissing his husband on stage next to Mr. Man Donald Trump.
All right, so there's more to that soundbite, and then there's a response that I thought was very interesting. But the point that he was making, and maybe what happens with Limbaugh and certainly people in the media, and I've been a target of this too, that when you say something, it sometimes gets twisted and misinterpreted. I think the way that Rush delivered that is part of the reason it's getting misinterpreted. But we've even talked about it in very real political tones on this show. I remember Senator Lamping on a roundtable in the last month, and I echoed this a couple of weeks ago. The question is, from a very real political perspective, is the country ready for a first husband? I think that was maybe the point that he was making, but we'll get into that because, again, there's a lot of controversy about that. And let me touch on one more thing here, because yesterday we played this audio. It ended up being the audio cut of the day. This student from the University of Virginia, African-American student, who stands up in the middle of the new multicultural center that they just opened up last Thursday and says this.
Public service announcement. Excuse me. If y'all didn't know, this is the MSC, and frankly, there's just too many white people in here, and this is a space for people of color. So just be really cognizant of the space that you're taking up, because it does make some of us POCs uncomfortable when we see too many white people in here. It's only been open for 4 days, and frankly, there's the whole university for a lot of y'all to be at, and there's very few spaces for us. So keep that in mind. Thank you.
I mean, it was still, every time I hear it, I've played it a few times here, and I'm rather stunned by that. Now, the University of Virginia, the reason I'm playing that again, the University of Virginia has responded. Actually, I thought I had their response here, but I'm going to have to look it up. They basically, they didn't really criticize the student, but they made it clear that that's a, you know, I guess a cultural center for everyone. And that probably shouldn't happen. But here, I predicted this yesterday. Did you guys, anybody out there, did you see that on CNN? Did you see it in any other media coverage? Dave, have you seen it anywhere? I haven't even really seen it on Fox. They covered it a little bit. There's a story on the website. The university released a statement yesterday affirming that all members of the community are welcome in the recently expanded multicultural student center after a video of a student stating there were too many white people using the facility that went viral. In order to foster the diversity of experience and ideas that make UVA a great and good place to study and work, these centers are open to all members of the university community. They complement existing student-focused spaces such as the blah, blah, blah. Anyway, they go in that. That video now has 2.7 million views. Can you imagine what kind of coverage this would have gotten had a student said something along those lines in the other direction? Holy cow. But you won't hear about this in most of the media.
Miss any part of the Mark Reardon Show? Download the podcast anytime.
Initiating download. Stand by.
At KMOX.com/Reardon.
Before we get into the serious matter that is Kim Gardner, where's Carol Daniels stand on the whole notion of whether or not you should recline your seat on an airplane? I think you and I have talked about this before. Did you see the video?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Randy and I are going to handle this and kind of get into it at 3:30. You're welcome to join at that point as well. But I mentioned this poll, Clay Travis, who's a really good sports guy out there on Twitter, put a poll up, and I voted in it this morning. For the record, he said, I am 100% opposed to seats reclining on airplane flights. Should airplane seats be designed to recline? I said, yes, but I'm in the minority. It was like, at this point, it was 69 to 31. Now, I haven't checked the
people who don't want them to recline.
60 to 30. Again, early in the process here, but why wouldn't you want them to recline? Why wouldn't you want to be comfortable?
Because you want it to decline. Those people who are answering, and I'm just guessing, they don't want it declined on them.
Yes.
And that's what they're answering.
Taller people in particular.
Yes.
I mean, it's you're banging into your knees.
I mean, and, you know, the airlines today, the seats are not large. There's not enough room. Right. And so you recline and you are now in my lap. So I get that. But I want to recline.
Yeah, me too. All right. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit later. So you went with our news director, Beth, last Friday to visit with Kim Gardner. Give us the background of what happened here.
So we in the newsroom and I won't say starting with Kevin, but he definitely the primary reporter who covers St. Louis City Hall. He is the St. Louis City Hall reporter. And so he has been covering St. Louis police, the mayor's, all issues related to St. Louis City Hall, and Kim Gardner, the St. Louis Circuit Attorney, being one of them. And our continuation of the story has been to try to get her, Kevin, to try to get her to respond to the St. Louis Police Department's numbers. And when we say numbers, we issued, Kevin issued a sunshine request of the St. Louis Police Department. How many charges, how many cases have you given to the circuit attorney's office? So from that sunshine request, we get this number from St. Louis Police that is somewhere like 7,000. They claim then that the circuit attorney's office has only issued charges in about 30-some-odd percent
right.
of those cases, I believe, for 2019. So in the last several months, the newsroom has been trying to get her office to respond to that. And so our news director, Beth Coughlin, and myself, we have all been trying to get a one-on-one interview. Number one, respond to the numbers. And from my standpoint, I just wanted to know even more about her office and her how she's responding to all of these various controversies.
Right. Well, look, there's a lot of legitimate
questions.
That's
the background of how it came to be anyway.
Yeah. And the rest of the background is, and look, we put plenty of requests out going back to last year for this show as well, but the rest of the background is there have been two interviews with national media and really none
recently.
So,
recently.
Right, I'm talking about the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, recent.
So on the issue of the charges and the numbers that you mentioned here, I think this is your question about that.
About the numbers of cases that supposedly your office is that are either being dismissed or you are not taking up. What's the real issue there that the public doesn't understand?
Well, first of all, no one has my numbers but me. So it's kind of ironic that anyone is talking about numbers. They don't have numbers of the prosecutor's office.
So the numbers that
they can't tell, they can't, that's like me saying I got the numbers for the police department. That's just, it is laughable.
But the police department would know how many felony charges were sent to her, wouldn't they? They just perhaps wouldn't know the level of prosecution. I don't understand that answer, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, and we pressed, and eventually I said to her that the only way that we'll have clarity is from you. And so I was thinking, is there something I don't know? I mean, is there something that we, that's why I asked the question in that way.
Right.
Is there something the public doesn't understand in the manner in which these things operate? A police officer goes to a crime scene. He writes a report. From that report is then given to the circuit attorney's office. And they say in that report, you know, I saw the guy, I clocked the guy doing 110. I took the dog. I found the stash. Here's
right, all the details.
All of the evidence. And then they send it to the circuit attorney's office. And so her office is currently compiling using new software to compile their case log, if you will. And so she's saying, what I gather, she's saying that what the police department has is just a large number. What we have is something different. We have the number of cases that were taken up that were then, you have, I think, 24 hours. You bring a case to her office, you have 24 hours, they send it back. There's not enough evidence. They send it back. That officer cannot testify. They send it back. That's an incomplete report. They send it back. There's a variety of reasons. They want to track all of that. And
So I've never... Here's what caught my ear this morning, and I will tell you, and I don't know if there was a follow-up on this or not, and I want to play this sound because it was one of the casts. I've never in my 35 years of covering courts, police, murder charges, trials, I've sat through trials, really interesting ones. I've never looked at a prosecutor and a police department having an adversarial relationship.
That doesn't make any sense.
Now, should I play the bite? All right.
Yeah. How would you characterize your relationship with the police department as a not you personally, but as an agency, as a part of the ecosystem?
It's always going to be an adversary relationship. I mean, we're going to always ask them to go back to complete their investigation, do more things. That is our job. We're a check and balance.
So I asked Jack Coder this only because he was a prosecutor, and I was going to reach out to Joe Mosley, who was a prosecutor for a long time in Central Missouri, also a former state senator. I'm not sure any other prosecutor would look at it as adversarial.
You know what's interesting? Because I had the same reaction, if you will. But what is also interesting is that hearing that answer, I thought that a police officer who goes to the scene and who writes a report and then takes it to a circuit attorney and he says or she says, not enough. I need more evidence.
And Coda that, said that. That, ha-
that would
happen.
Be adversarial.
I don't think it's adversarial. That's
well, I mean, and maybe that's the wrong word, but there is a push and pull here because police are on the street. They're doing their thing.
But the push and pull should be for the prosecution of people who are breaking the law.
Now, here's my other reaction to that.
That makes no sense
here's my other reaction to that, Mark. What was also intriguing to me is there is certainly a school of thought that prosecutors and police are too much hand in hand. And we have had those cases where prosecutors are not doing their due diligence. And she said to me later in the interview that I can't say to them, you know, write it this way. I can't say to them, she was describing, you know, some aspect, some scenario as being illegal. I can't, as a prosecutor, she said, tell police.
I understand all that.
So I get that. But do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. But does she understand how this is perceived and how?
Yes, I think she does.
Creating a relationship.
And I think she doesn't. And when I would say, in my words, Carol Daniel, reporter who sat with her for almost 3 hours, I would say that she does not care. And that's not apathy, but she said to us that justice is the end result, not convictions.
How does justice play into the shooting of, you know,
whatever you're about to say, I can't answer.
But do you ask her those questions about why there's not a prosecution of a guy who killed a child when the feds
have prosecuted? We did not go into specific cases. I did not ask those questions.
That's the one thing out there that I would love to know the answer for, because the feds have gotten involved in that because he confessed, but she has not issued charges.
You're bringing up
What's going to happen with this, though, because you guys have turned this into a special, right, for tomorrow?
It's going to air tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour and then again in the evening, I believe at 10 p.m. or 11 p.m. And there is a follow-up because she talked about this process she's going through and it's something that was started with when Jennifer Joyce was the circuit attorney. Kim Gardner says that circuit attorney's offices throughout the country do not have a good system of tracking cases, of tracking what happens. And so Jennifer Joyce began this process and her office is continuing to build this software for which they have gotten grant money to better track what happens. And I asked her, are you working with police so that they can do a better job, if that's what you're saying is true?
It sounds like it.
And she said yes. Her office goes to the where police trained when they become police officers.
The academy?
They go to the academy. They talk to them about that. So she says they do.
The special will be on 10 o'clock tomorrow.
10 o'clock. 10 a.m. and 10 p.m.
Oh, that'll be easy.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
From pitchers and catchers reporting through the final pitch of the spring. Hey, it's Chris Raby. Listen for my spring training reports from the T.R. Hughes broadcast location in Jupiter, Florida. T.R. Hughes Home, St. Charles' premier new home building. On your home, the Cardinals KMO.
Who directed the new Apollo 11 IMAX film. And I have to find out because, you know, the Apollo 11 film came out last year, the great documentary, and this is called the First Steps Edition, and it's going to play at the Science Center. I think it's starting today. And Todd Douglas Miller, the director, is by in the next hour. Chris Raby, we started this about a month ago, a Raby rant at 3:30 on Thursdays. And we're going to talk about this. It's gone viral today on Twitter. The guy who was not happy with the woman in front of him on an airplane flight and started, she reclined her seat. He starts, you know, just knocking on the back of the seat nonstop, being a, rhymes with wick, I think. Can I say that, Dave? That won't get me fined, right? But people, man, people are worked up about this. So we'll get to that here in a second. So I read a column this morning in the Federalist, and I thought it was interesting about the whole Roger Stone thing. Now, I will state on the record that it makes me uncomfortable. I know that many of you out there think that whatever Donald Trump does is okay. I tend to think that there are things where he crosses the line. I made it very clear that I think he did that with the Ukraine call, although I did not find it an impeachable offense. And for the most part, look, he's treated unfairly by the media. But in this particular case, I do have some questions from a couple of different perspectives. I think it's a legitimate question to ask whether or not the president interfered with this and with Bill Barr. But it's also a legitimate question to ask, wait a second, how did they come up with 9 years? So this column in the Federalist this morning talked about some of the components. You have the statutory range, 5 to 40 years. And two of the crimes that Stone was convicted of, obstructing a congressional investigation, false statements to Congress, provide a sentence of 0 to 5 years. And the third provides for a sentence of 0 to 20 years. You hear, you know, these ranges all the time. One of the things that annoys me, and I didn't want to correct him yesterday, it wasn't really a matter of correction. You'll hear news coverage all the time. This is a pet peeve of mine, and I used to be a news director, and I told my anchors and reporters not to do this because it's stupid, quite honestly. And they still do it. It doesn't matter. He can spend up to 175 years behind bars. I don't think that's going to happen. Okay, so the range is the range. That doesn't mean it's going to be the actual punishment. So the person who wrote about this morning in the Federalist said, and it was a federal criminal defense attorney, said the range shocked me as unduly high given the nonviolent nature of the underlying crimes. To provide some perspective, a multitude of violent crimes comes with lower guidelines calculations. For example, if you use a gun during a crime of violence or drug trafficking, the guidelines is 60 months, the range. If you brandish a gun during the same, the guidelines range is 84 months. So in this particular case, when the government filed its sentencing memorandum, it calculated a guideline range of 87 to 108 months. Again, clearly out of the range of some more violent crimes. So Brad Young is with me this afternoon. Brad, I appreciate you hanging on while I sort of set that up, but I wanted to get your opinion, find out what you thought of the sentencing guidelines here. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's great to be with you this afternoon.
All right. So what would you say specifically on the range of punishment, whether they were trying to go a little bit too hardcore compared to these other sentences of perhaps more violent crimes?
Well, first of all, the sentencing guidelines are extremely complex. I mean, I have a copy that's 608 pages long just for the guidelines. So we're talking about something that's very complex. Now, to boil that down into something that we can discuss and digest, in this particular instance, the bump up in what would normally be sentencing for these types of crimes, he was only convicted of three crimes, obstructing a congressional investigation, false statements to Congress, and witness tampering. For those three, basically the sentencing guidelines without any additions or subtractions would be somewhere between 0 and 20 years total for all three. Now, within that range, and that's according to the statute, within that range, in order to add or subtract what's being recommended, at least from the prosecutor's standpoint here, the former prosecutor's standpoint now, it's all basically rests on two statements that Roger Stone made. He told one of the witnesses, prepare to die, and he also threatened to take
Well, let's be clear. He said, prepare to die, blank sucker. All right. And then he threatened to take that dog away from you.
Exactly. So what in on that particular crime of obstructing a congressional investigation, that takes the sentencing guidelines. If you agree that those two statements constitute a threat or witness tampering or harassment of a witness, if you look at it, that doubles the sentencing for those crimes. And that's how the prosecutors got to this number. Now, the problem with that theory is, in this particular instance, the person that those statements were said to, the witness who Roger Stone spoke those things to, he testified by letter stating that he denied that he felt threatened, and he chalked it up to Stone being Stone, who's all right. bark and no bite.
Right, right, right.
Okay? So the likelihood, the bottom line, I guess, is very complex, but the bottom line is that a judge, in all likelihood, would not look at that as a legitimate threat, and if that's not a legitimate threat, then those additives to the sentencing, which doubled the time that Roger Stone could at least allegedly spend behind bars, that would disappear at a pre-sentencing advisory hearing because the judge would not find that to be a credible threat.
Right. But this is where things sort of become interesting. The government files its sentencing submission February 10th at 6:30 p.m. The following morning, 12:57, Trump tweets disgraceful to a tweet that says any reasonable person knows that if this is the actual sentence for Roger Stone, it's an unhinged miscarriage of justice. So obviously then people think it's presidential interference. There's no evidence right now that the president has interfered. He's denied it. He says he didn't speak to anyone at the Department of Justice. But obviously people are losing their mind. And the timing of this is because then the government files a supplemental sentencing submission. They back away from not only the 8-point enhancement, but the other enhancements as well. You have four people that resigned from the department. So what do you make of all that?
Well, here's what I make of it. Understandably so, people can be upset if there's political pressure being applied by the president to reduce the recommending sentencing guidelines. But from my perspective, it's equally abhorrent if there's political pressure being put on the prosecutors to inflate those guidelines, because at least two of those prosecutors, I believe, served on the Mueller team.
Right.
So if their politics affected their sentencing recommendations, to me that's just as bad as if there was some influence, which there's no evidence of, but if there was some influence from the White House to reduce those sentencing guidelines, to me I think both of those are synonymous.
Yeah, well, and look, I think one of the questions here is whether or not, because Barr says, or whether it's him himself, the DOJ says they were not briefed, they were not told, that they were to a certain extent blindsided by these recommendations, right?
Yeah, they were, and as we've already talked about, Mark, those recommendations were made prior to Trump making any tweets or even becoming cognizant of this.
Yeah, what would happen? Let me ask this in a hypothetical. Let's say that someone was convicted of spying, Brad, like espionage. That's pretty, you know, that's a pretty serious crime. And then the 35-year sentence was reduced to 6 years. By another president. Let's say it was President Obama who did that. Wait a second. That happened with Chelsea Manning, didn't it?
I'm sorry. No, really?
I'm sorry.
Absolutely it did. Chelsea Manning sentenced to 35 years. President Obama got involved. That got reduced to 6 years.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Anyway, I think that this is, in other words, and I think, again, I stated from the beginning here, I think there are very legitimate questions about whether or not there was interference here with the DOJ, but I think there's the side of the story that we just explained as well with these sentencing guidelines that were a little off the rails. You're saying, though, let's say that, just to be clear, let's say that none of this happened with Trump's tweets. It goes through as usual. It gets to the judge, and the judge probably doesn't give that sentence because he takes a closer look?
Right. I mean, the likelihood of the judge actually taking those adjustments into consideration, I think, are slim to none, and none's coming up fast, simply because if you look historically, there's no gun use here, there's no violence here, there's no drug use here. Those are the kind of things that judges typically take into consideration.
Yeah.
None of that's here, and we've got two statements where the person who was the object of those statements has already stated in a letter and would probably testify at a pre-sentencing hearing that he didn't feel threatened. And if he didn't feel threatened, the judge cannot use the statements to make adjustments to the sentencing guidelines.
KMOX legal analyst Brad Young helping us out this afternoon. I appreciate it, man. Thank you very much.
Hey, my pleasure as always.
248.
Listening to KMOX has never been easier.
Siri, play KMOX.
Reardon Roundtable tomorrow. We'll be talking about, I think we'll probably talk about Roger Stone and Kim Gardner and New Hampshire and Bernie Sanders and maybe even this topic. So I heard the intro to this. I was in the one of the production studios doing some work for the show earlier this afternoon, and I saw this come up on CNN, and Breonna Keeler introduced it this way.
Just a week after receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom, right-wing radio personality Rush Limbaugh is making offensive and what you could easily call homophobic remarks. They are homophobic about Pete Buttigieg, the first openly gay presidential candidate. This is what Limbaugh said.
All right, so I don't think they're homophobic in and of themselves, but certainly when Rush puts his flair into something, it's going to come off that way. But let's kind of analyze what he said.
They're sitting there and they're looking at Mayor Pete. 37-year-old gay guy, Mayor South Bend, loves to kiss his husband on the debate stage. And they're saying, okay, how's this going to look? 37-year-old gay guy kissing his husband on stage next to Mr. Man Donald Trump. What's going to happen there? And they got to be looking at that, and they've got to be saying.
Now, he's talking about Democrats here. Democrats who are trying to put a ticket together to beat Donald Trump and remove him from the Oval Office.
That despite all the great progress and despite all the great wokeness and despite all the great ground that's been covered, America's still not ready to elect a gay guy kissing his husband on the debate stage president. They have to be saying this, don't they? Now, there may be some Democrats who think that is the ticket. Maybe some Democrats who think that's exactly what we need to do, Rush. Get a gay guy kissing his husband on stage, to ram it down Trump's throat, and beat him in a general election. Really? Having fun envisioning that.
Now, look, his point is one that I've made before. Other people on the roundtable have made before. Let me ask those of you, and I'll ask this to Jane and who's on the panel tomorrow, Jeff Smith. I'll ask them. I'll say, look, is his point inaccurate? I personally don't know if this is true. We'll find out, certainly. I don't think the country is ready for a first husband. That's sort of the way Senator Lamping put it when he was on the roundtable a couple of weeks ago. I've said that as well. Just a personal opinion. I think Rush is right about that. And by the way, this is not a Republican thing. This is a Democrat thing because African-Americans not hugely in favor of gay marriage or homosexuality. Why Mayor Pete is polling in single digits and maybe even lower in South Carolina. You have Catholic voters, religious voters, Democrats, not unlike that woman who went to the Iowa caucuses. We played the audio a couple of weeks ago, had no idea how this is even possible. I don't know. But she was completely oblivious. When a young woman told her, when she found out that Mayor Pete had a husband, she said, well, that's against, you know, that goes against the Bible. And there was a nice young woman who was there at the caucus who was trying to talk her through it. And I gave that young girl all kinds of credit for being very patient. But there are a lot of people in these states. And that's, I think, the political point. Now, does he make it in a way that the people on CNN are going to go nuts? Yes, he does. Absolutely. So here's SC Cup. Now, she's a never-Trumper.
Well, it's kind of a laughable argument that a five-time draft dodger germaphobe is somehow more manly than a guy who served in Afghanistan. But, you know, you do you, Rush. Look, a funny thing happened in 2016. Republicans, when they voted for Donald Trump and accepted his multiple infidelities, multiple accusations of sexual assault, his grab him by the pussy remarks, whether they voted for him enthusiastically or through some kind of Faustian bargain, they really forfeited any moral authority over what a guy does behind closed doors. In this case, Mayor Pete's private monogamous gay marriage.
Now, I think SC Cup, to a certain extent, is right about part of that, because I've said this before, too, and I know that many of you don't want to confront this, but you really have. You've sacrificed forever, from now into the future, the ability to criticize people over character. That's not what this is about. This is about whether the country and whether Democratic voters, not only Republican voters, you have to nominate some, whether Democratic voters think this is the right time for a first husband. It's just a human nature thing. Not trying to be homophobic. I think Rush's handicapping of that was absolutely on target. I think SC Cup needs to think about that just a little bit. But that's becoming somewhat controversial today because of what Mr. Limbaugh said. Second hour of the show is coming up.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.